Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. Back in the 1980s, the then Secretary of the Navy, Lehman, is quoted as saying, "Diplomatic power is the shadow cast by military and naval power." And the question is, for today's episode, does that apply to space power? For diplomacy, as many will probably agree, that is a very important instrument of national power along with all the others, and diplomacy forms a vital part of any nation's strategic toolkit. For the United States, it is the preferred method of addressing various international matters for various reasons, one of which is that we as a nation are invested in the present international system or world order, and as the leader of such an order, maintaining the status quo is in our best interest. However, relying upon diplomacy without sufficient strength in the other areas, including economic and military, typically does not lead to success, at least not a lasting sense of success. Especially with adversary nations that are seeking to supplant the current U.S.-led world order with one led by them, China or Russia, or really a combination of their axis, including Iran and North Korea. Recently, you may not have heard this because I really haven't seen much of this in the press, but speaking of diplomatic, Ambassador Bruce Turner, who is the U.S. ambassador to the Committee on Disarmament at the United Nations, tweeted out, or X'd out, however you prefer, said, "Today, the UN First Committee reaffirmed the world opposes nuclear weapons in space. Thanks to the hard work by Argentina, Japan, the U.S., and 55 additional co-sponsors, 160 UN members uplifted and enhanced the Cornerstone Outer Space Treaty." Now, for those of you that don't know what the First Committee is, at the UN you have the Security Council, which most folks are familiar with, and then there's the General Assembly, which is the big, massive assembly of every member, not just the permanent five plus a couple. And the First Committee is essentially kind of like an executive committee, and they kind of get together and discuss things and propose resolutions and things of that sort. And so what happened here is you had a resolution of the First Committee, which passed this resolution reconfirming the importance of the Outer Space Treaty's no nuclear weapons in space provision. So I think I'm going to give you a little bit of background on why this is really not a big deal and why it's really not helpful in the long run. So a little bit of background. First, the Outer Space Treaty started out as a resolution in 1966, prior to it being drafted into a full-up treaty that came out in 1967. And that resolution that was passed recently that says nuclear weapons should not be based in space or on celestial bodies was in that resolution over 50 years ago. And the actual treaty that came out a year later also has the exact same message in it. So this treaty was and is still considered by many to have the force of, quote, international law. And it states that WMD, not just nuclear weapons, are not to be based in space or on the moon and other celestial bodies. However, as I mentioned on a few previous episodes of Real Space Strategy, many have argued that this Outer Space Treaty has already been breached and by the Russians, then Soviet Union. In the late 1960s, after the Outer Space Treaty had been ratified, 1967 thereabouts, Secretary McNamara held a press conference to discuss the fact that the Soviet Union had tested what they called a fractional orbital bombardment system, or FOBS, and that term was created by the Johnson administration for reasons that you'll see shortly. The weapon consisted of a modified R-36 missile, the R-36-ORB, that placed a 2 to 3 megaton warhead into an orbital trajectory over the southern hemisphere in order to evade U.S. early warning radar and possibly anti-ballistic missile systems that were being developed at that time by flying lower and approaching from the south using a retro rocket to deorbit itself. When Secretary McNamara announced the test, he argued that they did not violate the treaty because, number one, they did not involve a warhead, an actual live warhead, so no nuclear weapon entered orbit. And number two, the test vehicle was deorbited before it achieved a full orbit, and three, weapon development was not prohibited by the treaty. Yet Secretary McNamara's interpretation angered many members of Congress, who argued that the FOBs represented a violation and questioned Soviet commitment to the treaty, which, as I mentioned, had only been passed just a few months prior to that. U.S. allies also privately raised concerns, and the U.S. intelligence community suggested that it could presage the development of a multi-orbit bombardment system. State Department officials, who had not been notified in advance about Secretary McNamara's announcement, argued internally that nothing in the treaty limited it to a full orbit. This internal discord was picked up and reported by the famous author Murray Marder of the Washington Post in a pointed piece titled Orbital Bomb Rationalizing Joints Officials. Also, General Ira Aker, former commander of 8th Air Force in World War II, also wrote several editorials arguing that this was indeed a violation of the treaty. But the State Department was overruled and subsequently adopted the administration's position, later noting that even if the test had involved a nuclear weapon, they would not be considered a violation because a, quote, true orbital bombardment system was imagined to station nuclear weapons in orbit on a more permanent basis. Even the name FOBS was carefully selected to ensure that the weapon would not be considered a violation. So it was that the Johnson administration set the bar in 1967. Violation would need to entail space-based nuclear weapons, not ground-based systems that temporarily place prohibited weapons into orbit. And this interpretation owed more to the administration's other needs. In particular, they were trying to get the Soviets' cooperation to finalize the far more important, in their minds, nuclear nonproliferation treaty than to choose a close reading of the text or concern about space-based weapons. However, unlikely it was that a space-based nuclear weapon would be deployed in their minds, government officials nevertheless dutifully prepared for verifying compliance with this prohibition. So, and this came, I quoted here from an article in the Space Review from several months ago. Now, when you look at other writings of the time, General Curtis LeMay, who was the commander of Strategic Air Command and later Chief of Staff of the Air Force before retiring in the middle of the Johnson administration, he also asserted in one of his books that the Soviet had in fact deployed an orbital nuclear weapon, and yet we looked the other way. Fast forward, the Cold War ended in 1991, thereabouts, and the Russians deactivated what operational FOB systems they had and shelved other planned nuclear and conventional space weapons for several decades due to economic incapacity. This is obviously all pre-Putin. Later on in the late 90s, early 2000s, Putin comes to power in Russia and begins the process to rebuild the Russian military, including its space forces. Fast forward even more, you have 2007, the Chinese do their kinetic ASAT weapons test, but because it was not a nuclear weapon and it was a ground-based system, it does not trigger concern of the magnitude of a nuclear space weapon, as the Outer Space Treaty does not forbid such activities. Discussions began in several forums, as mentioned on previous episodes, such as the UN, to work on putting those weapons, the kinetic non-nuclear weapons, back into the research and development only box, to little avail with China and Russia both. So fast forward to 2024, members of Congress then come out stating concerns about the Russian nuclear ASAT weapon, and coupled with that of a 2021 Chinese test of their own FOB systems and Russia rebuilding their own, which could carry nuclear weapons as well as hypersonic glide vehicles. And this obviously has been in the news quite a bit. So as a result of that, the current administration decided that the best way to handle that was through diplomatic means. And as I mentioned, the U.S. is typically prefers the diplomatic mean as the primary way of using instruments of national power and not going straight to the military. So what they initially did was try to get people to not do kinetic weapons testing. And who vetoed that? The Russians and the Chinese, the Iranians, and the North Koreans. So that didn't work out. U.S. then self-imposes its own ban on kinetic ASAT testing, and U.S. and others are now trying to get a U.N. Security Council resolution in the past several months reaffirming the Outer Space Treaty ban on WMDs in space. Russia vetoes it. So because Russia vetoes the UN resolution on nuclear weapons in space, as reported in Space News and other places, the Arms Control Association and other organizations of similar viewpoints believe that states should affirm support for the Outer Space Treaty despite the Russian veto. Now, the State Department event that I just read you the tweet about happened just a few weeks ago, I believe in Geneva. And now the State Department and the DoD have spent tons of work time on getting the first committee of the UN General Assembly to say that nuclear weapons in space are bad and should be prohibited from being there. It took 50 separate recorded votes, and there were 15 drafts on various weapons, one including the Outer Space Treaty's view on nuclear weapons. So while scores of nation states supported it, and that was hailed as a success, guess who did not support it? China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. Either by not voting for it at all, and either abstaining or downright voting against it. So a few questions came to my mind, and there are several, so bear with me here. Number one, if the Russians and Chinese and their friends and partners in crime don't already abide by a treaty that has been in force for over 60 years, why would another resolution, either from the Security Council or the General Assembly, matter? As a follow-up, if Russia in particular has a less than stellar compliance record with multiple treaties, resolutions, conventions, norms, etc., and they have violated or abrogated just about all treaties they have signed into since the czars were in power in the late 1800s, why are we surprised when they do what they do? Why do we think that treaties and resolutions will have any effect on such a country? Have treaties, resolutions, demarches, or international court rulings stopped Russia from invading multiple countries since 1991? Have they stopped China from claiming territory and harassing nations in the Western Pacific and even as far east as off the coast of South America? Has it stopped Iran from backing proxies such as Hamas, Hezbollah, or outright attacking their neighbors in acts of war such as ballistic missile barrages? You add North Korea into the mix. What has stopped them from sending troops to Russia to fight with Russia or sinking ships and killing South Koreans in artillery attacks? Or in space, preventing any of these states from attacking our critical space infrastructure at low threshold attacks such as jamming and lasing and preparing for high-intensity war in the space area of responsibility? Think about that for a little bit. Here's a few more questions to ponder. Number two, why is the resolution, which is something that has already been said before the Outer Space Treaty, considered a, quote, enhancement of a treaty that already exists and supposedly has the force of law? In other words, how is voting for the same resolution making the treaty more effective when the people who were concerned about voted against it, even though they're a signatory of the treaty, and their behavior is showing that they obviously don't really care? Number three, here's another question. How can a treaty or resolution, regardless of how many are voted on, be enforced by the UN if the Security Council, as mentioned earlier, they try to do a resolution on this whole thing? If the Security Council, which is supposed to be the enforcement mechanism of the UN organization, does not pass its own resolution of support for international legal regimes like the Outer Space Treaty? And the reason why, obviously, is because Russia and China are both permanent five veto holders, and they both either abstain or veto it. Thus, the resolution didn't carry. Number four, some are even arguing for another whole treaty. There was an article in Space News that was an editorial by a graduate student titled "Bind Russia to a New Arms Control Treaty to Ban Nuclear Weapons in Space." So he's arguing essentially that another treaty that says exactly the same thing will, quote, bind Russia with nuclear weapons in space. So how exactly does another treaty bind Russia when others, including the Outer Space Treaty, have not bound them to such responsible behavior? Or rather, kept them from doing aggressive behavior. And number five, what exactly is the benefit or success of having a majority of UN states support your position on a resolution that is already stated in several preceding resolutions and a legally binding treaty? Besides the symbolic, if those nations have no power or means to enforce such a resolution because of their size, lack of power projection capabilities or resources, and a majority of them do not have those capabilities, what impact would such a resolution actually have upon the target adversary states, great powers of China, Russia, and minor powers Iran and North Korea, who were allied and funded and provided training and everything from the other two? And the answer to this question is nothing at all. Beyond the symbolic, it has no real effect. It doesn't achieve anything new. It does not change the behavior or plans of the aforementioned aggressor states deploying such nuclear space weapon systems and likely sharing that technology information with the other three. So I have been told by friends and colleagues that while messaging might imply that prevention of bad behavior of China and Russia is the goal of such treaties and resolutions at the UN and other forums, I've been told by these same people that, oh, it's really not the real reason they're pursued. I understand that it is important to try, but rather than doing the same thing over and over again and repeating the same language over and over again, why not try something different? Both major great power challengers, China and Russia, respect strength and hard power. They may talk a good game in support of peaceful purposes while simultaneously killing hundreds of thousands of people, but in order to reassert deterrence and shape these aggressor nations back into their boxes, requires a buildup of space forces to deter, deny, degrade, or destroy nuclear ASATs or any adversary space weapons from having free rein in orbit or beyond. Preventing space to be the place where our homeland is attacked, either conventionally by orbit-based space nuclear weapons or otherwise. So how can we do this? Well, here's a few suggestions, and we might explore these more in depth in future episodes. But number one, as mentioned many times before, turn the Space Force, U.S. Space Command, into a deterrence and warfighting space force and not just a renamed Air Force Space Command Terrestrial Support Organization. Number two, give Combined Space Operations, or CSPO, some teeth. So Combined Space Operations, or CSPO, is an agreement between what's known as the Five Eyes, initially the main allies, European allies of the United States, UK, Canada, things of that sort. And several other countries have been joining the CSPO, but they don't have any real weapon systems. So they're more of a support group to stand together and make statements than they are really like an alliance of sorts. But I think we should make it into an alliance because you have friends like France pursuing capabilities for offensive and defensive capabilities to protect their own space assets. And Japan is doing something similar, according to open source reports. So it's beyond time we treat space threats like we do air, land, and sea and build up our allies' capabilities to wage a credible deterrent and war-winning force if necessary, rather than trying to continue to pretend that taking the high ground and self-restraining ourselves from doing what is necessary is somehow helping. And lastly, we should pursue new and enforceable diplomatic agreements that include enforcement mechanisms beyond weak sanctions or more resolutions that have little to no impact. As Secretary of the Navy Lehman mentioned at the beginning of this commentary, you know, diplomacy is very important, but it's just a shadow of the military power that backs it up. So with that, that concludes this commentary with Real Space Strategy. I hope you take time to ponder those questions, and we look forward to talking about it more in the future. So for now, this is Christopher Stone for Real Space Strategy. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.